I often wonder how some people know when it's time to flee their country, just before a war or genocide, while others stay. The new book, The Lost, tells the story of Daniel Mendelssohn's great-uncle Shmuel, who stayed in his Ukrainian town after his siblings left. Shmuel, his wife, and their four daughters died in the Holocaust. When Shmuel realized what was in store for the Jews, he wrote letters to his relatives in America begging for help in getting out. Mendelssohn found Shmuel's letters in the wallet of Mendelssohn's late grandfather. How Mendelssohn learned the rest of the story is the subject of his book. Daniel Mendelssohn is a contributor to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Book Review. He teaches at Bard College. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of The Lost.
Some time ago, when I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old, it would occasionally happen that I'd walk into a room and certain people would begin to cry. The rooms in which this happened were located, more often than not, in Miami Beach, Florida, and the people on whom I had this strange effect were, like nearly everyone else in Miami Beach in the mid-1960s, old. Like nearly everyone else in Miami Beach at that time, or so it seemed to me then, these old people were Jews, Jews of the sort who were likely to lapse when sharing prize bits of gossip or coming to the long-delayed endings of stories or to the punchlines of jokes into Yiddish, which of course had the effect of rendering the climaxes, the points of these stories and jokes, incomprehensible to those of us who were young. Like many elderly residents of Miami Beach in those days, these people lived in apartments or small houses that seemed, to those who did not live in them, slightly stale, and which were on the whole quiet, except on those evenings when the sound of the Red Skelton or Milton Berle or Lawrence Welk shows blared from the black and white television sets. At certain intervals, however, their stale, quiet apartments would grow noisy with the voices of young children who had flown down for a few weeks in the winter or spring from Long Island or the New Jersey suburbs to see these old Jews, and who would be presented to them, squirming with awkwardness and embarrassment, and forced to kiss their papery, cool cheeks.
That's Daniel Mendelssohn reading from his new book, The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million. At the beginning of the reading, you say that you had family members who cried when you came into the room. Did you ever know why they were crying?
Well, I did. I did know why they were crying. It may not have been clear to me when it first started happening, but it was soon very obvious to me that the reason they were crying was that I bore or was said to have borne this uncanny resemblance to my grandfather's brother, my great-uncle Shmuel, who had been killed in the Holocaust. And so at some moment, you know, in the way that children's consciousnesses become aware of things, I understood what it was and why this was happening. And for a long time, I don't think I made much of it because of the way in which you accept things as part of your family story or family behavior. And it may be crazy to other people, but you accept it. And then, of course, it was much later when I started to be interested in the story of this person and to whom I was supposed to bear this resemblance.
So, you know, Shmuel is your great uncle who stayed behind in Eastern Europe and died in the Holocaust. And did your family talk about Shmuel, why he stayed, how he died? Did they talk about him a lot? Did they speculate much?
My grandfather, to whom I was very close growing up and who was a great, you know, raconteur in a wonderful style and very mesmerizing as a storyteller, told a lot of stories about a lot of things. He grew up in this small, then Austro-Hungarian and subsequently Polish town at the beginning of the 20th century, and he liked to talk about his experiences. The one thing that he didn't like to talk about was his brother. He told me some things about his brother, as long as it didn't have to do with his brother's death and what happened to Shmuel and his family in the Holocaust. And one thing that struck me only much later as an adult was the information. And this my grandfather didn't tell me until toward the end of his life, and it came to me as a great surprise, which was that Shmuel, who was always sort of known as the one who stayed behind, you know, my grandfather was one of 7 siblings, and 6 of them emigrated, and only Shmuel remained in Poland. And what came as such a surprise was the information, then new to me, that Shmuel had actually come to the United States in 1913 as an 18-year-old young man to sort of explore the possibilities of resettling the family in New York City. And he came alone and stayed with an aunt and uncle, his mother's brother and his family, in New York City on the Lower East Side, and decided he didn't like America and went back to Poland. He didn't think there was any future for him in America. And so he went back in 1914. Then, of course, World War I started, and he was a soldier in the Austro-Hungarian army. And the rest is history. You know, you have to, I think one of the really important and crucial and interesting points about thinking about people who stayed behind is we now know it was, so to speak, a mistake, you know, and we look back and we say, oh, well, you know, didn't they see the writing on the walls or something like that? But, you know, after World War I, he was a prosperous businessman. He had a good life, a nice wife, four children. He was very successful. And it wasn't until really the bitter end, as in the very late 30s, that it became clear that the world was going to change in a very bad way. And so to us, the decision to go back looks suicidal almost. You know, people are always shocked to hear that. But of course, he didn't have the benefit of hindsight as we do. And to him, it looked like the right choice.
Well, you found your grandfather died in 1980, and sometime after he died, you found several letters that your great uncle Schmuel had written to his brother, your grandfather, and they were all asking for help from your grandfather and his family to help get the brother and his family out, to give them money, to provide help, to offer contacts, do something. And reading these letters, which you reprint in the book, it's like finding these artifacts. And I'm going to ask you to read several of the excerpts for us.
Sure. The letters that Schmuel wrote, the first one is dated in January 39, and the last one we know miraculously made it through to New York in December of 39, which is to say after the war started. And here's a letter in which he's very anxious about the world situation and clearly also self-conscious about having to hector his relatives in America. If only the world were open and I had been able to send one child to America or Palestine, it would be easier, since today children cost a great deal to send, particularly girls. Dear God should only grant that the world should be quiet, because now it's absolutely clouded. One lives constantly in terror. Don't be broigus, which is Yiddish for angry. Don't be broigus with me, my dears, because I write to you so many letters in this pessimistic vein. It's no wonder. In life now there are so many opportunities for people to be so evil to each other. I've now written to you so many times, dear A.B.
And later in letters, he starts almost like begging the family, help get me out of here. Would you read some of that?
Yeah, there's a point at which the desperation is quite patent. You should make inquiries. You should write that I'm the only one in your family still in Europe, and that I have training as an auto mechanic, and that I've already been to America from 1912 to 1913. Perhaps that might work. For my part, I'm going to post a letter written in English to Washington, addressed to President Roosevelt, and I'll write that all my siblings and my entire family are in America, and that my parents are even buried there. Perhaps that will work. And consult with my sister-in-law, Mina, and maybe she can give you some advice about this, as I really want to get away from this Gehenim, this hell, with my dear wife and such darling four children. I emphasize here to you that I do not want to leave here without something to live on. Life is the most precious thing of all, as long as you've got a roof over your head and bread in your mouth and all is safe and sound. I'll now close my letter for today and await a swift answer to the whole question and what you have to say about it.
There's one more excerpt I want you to read. And this is in response to a letter Schmuel has gotten from your grandfather.
Dear A.B., I was just about to send this when at that very moment I received your letter. You upbraid my dear wife for not having turned to her brothers and sisters. And so I write to you saying that you're out of your mind, She already wrote to them and never got an answer. What should she do?
Do you know why your family in America didn't send him money? Did they not have the money? Was your great uncle the kind of person who was always asking favors? Were they annoyed with him for that? Did they not understand how dire the situation was for Jews in Eastern Europe?
Well, it's an interesting question because it raises what to me is such a thorny and also interesting and poignant issue, which is, you know, we, of course, have all of Schmiel's letters to my grandfather and his other siblings in New York, but we don't know what they did. There's no way of knowing what they wrote back, so to speak. I mean, except to parse it from internal clues in the letters that Schmiel's writing. And, for example, at one point he makes a reference to money that my grandfather did send. So clearly he sent something. But whether they were able to send $5,000, which is an enormous sum of money to ordinary middle-class people in the year 1939, we have no way of knowing except from what Schmiel writes. And it's impossible to tell whether his increasing impatience with the American siblings is a reflection of reality, so to speak. In other words, a reflection of the fact that they weren't helping at all, or was instead the impatience of a doomed man who understands that the world is locking down around him, no matter what the relatives were doing. I mean, we simply don't know. You know, in the book, I mention this. You know, in this letter that my grandfather sent to Schmiel, to which Schmiel angrily refers in the segment that I wrote, you know, my grandfather could have said many things. He could have said, we have exhausted every legal possibility. We have tried to wire you money. Have you also asked your wife's relatives? Or he could have said, stop bothering us with these endless pestering letters. We've done what we could. Go ask her relatives. You know, it's impossible to tell the tone of the response. But that, to me, was very interesting, and it raised for me an issue that I wanted to really get to the bottom of in the book, which is to try to resuscitate the personalities of these lost people, and that includes my grandfather and many other of those old Jews in Miami Beach that I refer to in the first page of the book, to make the book be about humans with human frailties and human failings and human emotions, and not just these sort of idealized people from the 1940s, which is how I was always forced to see them, you know, just a bunch of faces and photographs and a little epithet here and there. But those letters were so electrifying to me because they suddenly brought out the personalities and the thorny issues involved.
To find the story of what actually happened to your great uncle during the Holocaust and to his wife and four daughters, you tracked down the surviving members of the town he lived in, Bolochov. How many people were in that town? How many people actually survived the Holocaust?
Well, the Jewish population of the town in 1939 was about 3,000. And when the Nazi occupation began, they rounded up the Jews from a lot of smaller towns nearby. So in 1941, there were 6,000 Jews in Bolochov. And of those 6,000, there were 48 survivors in 1944 when the Soviets liberated the town. And of those 48 survivors in 1944, it turned out that 12 were still alive in 2003 when I began my travels all over the world, tracking them down, trying to get them to tell the story.
Did you find all 12?
I did. Well, you know, it was funny because it was like dominoes. You know, once I found one, but I found all the rest because they all know each other. They're all in touch with each other, either by mail or actually email. A lot of them are on email. So I made contact with the first one in February 2002, and he told me then he had heard that I was looking for relatives of the Yeager family in Bolochov, and he called me from Sydney, Australia one night out of the blue. I didn't even know who he was. And he said, well, I heard you're looking for the Yeagers from Bolochov. And he said, if that's true, you should come to Australia. And I said, why? And he said, because there's 5 Balakhavar Jews, survivors, living in Sydney, and you should come talk to us. So I did. I got on a plane with my brother Matt, and we went to Australia. And once we were in Australia, you know, we interviewed them, and that was just amazing and really helped us a lot to get to the personalities of my lost family and what happened to them. And then as we were leaving, they said, oh, have you been to Stockholm? And I said, who's in Stockholm? And they told us. And then when we went to Stockholm, you know, somebody in Stockholm said, oh, you must go to Tel Aviv. And we went to Tel Aviv. So it was, you know, it was like in the old movies when you see somebody's peregrinations around the globe and there's that little arrow that is drawn from country to country.
Right.
And that's what it really was, zigzagging back and forth crazily sometimes. So it was really like following the bouncing ball. And that's what we did. We found them all.
One of the things you learned was that there were basically 2 different slaughters in which the Germans mm-hmm. killed most of the Jews in mm-hmm. Bolokhov. What did you learn about those 2 events?
Well, there were what we learned, and this was in Australia when we really started to get the full picture, because you have to understand, we didn't know anything. When I started this book, we did not know anything except what was available in, like, you know, a Holocaust encyclopedia, which is very clipped. And we learned it quite typically for a town in this area in eastern Poland. There was an initial, the Nazis came in the summer of 1941, and there was an initial action or mass killing in the fall of 1941. They killed 1,000 people in a mass grave, machine gunned in a mass grave. And that's when one of my Uncle Schmiel's daughters was taken. She just happened to be out on the street that day and got caught in a dragnet and was marched over to this open pit and killed there. And what was interesting is that between 1941 and 1942, the death camps began to run in earnest, and Belzec began to run. And so in the autumn of 1942 was the second Aktion, and that's when most of the Balakhov Jews were killed. There was an Aktion that lasted three days, in which they rounded up 2,500 people, and they kept them in the courtyard of the city hall for a number of days when they killed most of the children. There were 500 people killed, and the remaining 2,000 were marched to the little town train station and put in cattle cars, and they went to Belzec, and that's where most of Bolokhov's Jews perished. And at that point, there remained about 1,000 people, and most of them were younger people, and most of my survivors, the people who were helping me, who remembered Schmiel and his family, were among those 1,000 young, healthy people who had been kept for last because they could work in the forced labor businesses. This was an industrial town, and they had a, you know, a sawmill and a barrel factory, and they were forced to work in them. And those people were eventually liquidated in 1943, except the ones who went into hiding.
There are so many interesting twists and turns and mysteries along the way in your family research that we can't possibly do justice to here. So I want to just skip ahead a bit. You mm-hmm. found the house where your great uncle, it turned out, had hidden in the basement. At least you thought you found that house. You thought you'd found that house. You thought you'd found that cramped basement or cellar, maybe cellar is a better word, that the family had hid out in.
Right.
And then after thinking, okay, this is it. You finally found it. You went into it. You experienced what that space was like. And then you met a neighbor you hadn't met before who said, no, that wasn't really the house.
Right.
And I love that part of the book because I think, among other things, it's so kind of telling about the excitement and also the limitations of history. Well, you know, had you not met that other neighbor, you never would have known it wasn't exactly the house.
Right. Although, you know, as you know, then we met another neighbor who said it was the house. So, I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, one of the issues that I was forced to confront in the researching and the writing of this book was precisely the limits of memory, the almost blurred quality that is the characteristic of so many of the stories that become the written authoritative histories that we read. And that day was an unbelievably emotional day in which we, quite by accident, so much of what happened in my research was accidental, starting with being contacted by Jack Green in Australia. But in that culminating day, we were told that there was this man who knew the story, the terrible story of the last of my relatives who were the object of a failed rescue attempt. And we were taken to a place where we were told that they had been hidden. Then we were told it was a different place. Then we were told it was the same place until we finally met somebody who was actually there the day it happened. And she told us exactly what happened and exactly where. But certainly that day becomes a kind of symbol almost of the problems of the limits of memory and history, because so many of the stories that I got along the way during the 2 years that I was traveling, tracking down the 12 Balakha people, so many of these stories were alternate versions, different versions, mm-hmm. versions of stories we had heard with some key detail different.
Once you found survivors of Balakha who knew your great uncle and his family, did you ask them if they knew about the responses that your great uncle was getting from the family in America in response to his pleas to help him get out of Balakha and into the United States?
Yeah, I did ask them. Well, I you know, at that point, of course, everybody was in the same boat. You know, everybody was frantically trying to think of a way out and had been writing to their American relatives. So I did ask them what the situation was, and one of them laughed, you know, when I mentioned to him Schmiel's letters. And this gentleman, whose name is Jack Green, and he's one of the Sydney Balakhovers, was the high school boyfriend of one of Schmiel's daughters. So he's very close to the family. And he sort of just waved a hand dismissively. He said, you know, people were writing letters like maniacs in 1939. He said it was already closed. You couldn't leave. And anyway, there were already in place in Poland, this is before the invasion by Hitler. You have to remember there was an extremely right-wing anti-Semitic government in place in Poland who were already passing very severe, restrictive economic measures against Jews. So these people already were having trouble getting their money out, you know, buying tickets. I mean, even if it had been possible, it was already, as this man said to me, verfallen. It was already hopeless, you know, it was a lost cause. So although they didn't specifically talk about Schmiel's letters, he just dismissed the whole idea. He said nobody at that point could get out, even if they had wanted to.
You've said that you've come to think of Europe as a giant cemetery.
Right.
Why?
Well, one of the things that you get from being immersed in the study of the Holocaust in any way, as a historian or in my fashion, which was much more personal and narrow, but anything that forces you to travel in Eastern Europe leaves you with this sense of the, I don't know how to say it in any other way but to say the wrongness of Europe as it is today. I mean, you're constantly reminded as you travel in Europe, if you're traveling with an eye to the Holocaust, of the bizarre absence of these many millions of people, and now, 60 years later, many more millions of people who would have been. And you can't get that out of your head, not least because so many of the physical remains of European Jewry, particularly in Eastern Europe where the devastation was so total, so many of the physical remains, the synagogues, the storefronts with Yiddish lettering still on the bricks, the Jewish cemeteries, the mikvahs, the ritual bath buildings, still with Stars of David carved above the lintels, you know, all of these things are still there. They're still there. And to be confronted with that is to just have brought home in the most devastating way both the sense of the recentness of this event, which sounds like a peculiar thing to say, but I mean, you realize it happened recently enough that there's still all the evidence, so to speak, is still there, and nobody has bothered to clean up. You're confronted with that, and so you think Europe today is completely other than it would have been in a way from which it will never recover. You know, my older brother Andrew said the most moving thing to me, and late into my research and traveling, and he said, "Well, you know," he said, "they feel like they're so remote, Uncle Schmiel and his wife and kids, because they died so long ago." He said, "But, you know, there's no reason in the 1970s that they would not have been, oh, yeah, you know, the Polish aunt and uncle and cousins that we would have to go see once a year in Poland if the whole history of the 20th century had been different." And that I just found electrifying because it brought home to me the fact that these people ought to have been alive in my lifetime. And of course, they're not. And many millions more are not. And in that sense, I feel like Europe is just a cemetery. And I say this as, you know, a scholar of the classics, a lover of high European culture, a person who believes in European civilization. But I really do feel like there's something poisonous and very haunted that I don't think I'll ever get over.
Your mother's mother, your grandmother on your mother's side, is buried in a cemetery in Queens in a section labeled the First Balakov Sick Benevolent Association. What was this association?
Well, a lot of the Jews who emigrated at the turn of the last century to the United States formed community associations so that, say, all the Jews from Balakov, now living on the Lower East Side, would contribute to a fund. And they would, in a very communal way, they would help the sick people if somebody got ill because, you know, of course, these are recent immigrants with not a lot of money. They would pool resources and they would also buy a plot of land in a cemetery and reserve it for people from that town. So even in the new world, even in death, they were all still representing the old shtetl that they came from. And that's what that was.
You know, having been to Balakov and done so much research there about how your family was killed, what does it mean to you now to see that, the First Balakov Sick Benevolent Association, in the cemetery?
Well, it's very moving to me because I think of it as a sort of colony, you know. And, of course, at the time these places were started up and these cemetery plots were bought in New Jersey and New York, you know, they could have no idea that the mother country, so to speak, would be erased from the face of the earth. And the fact of what subsequently happened during the Holocaust gives, in my mind, a special poignancy to these little outposts of Balakov and all these other places, of course, in the New World. I think of them. I'm glad they're there, because if they weren't there, there would be no trace of this place anywhere.
You know, I can't remember whether it was in your book or in an article I was reading, which you talk about what went through your mind after first reading about Abu Ghraib and the human pyramid that was formed there of naked Iraqi prisoners.
Right.
Tell us what it made you think about.
Well, one of the pieces of information that I got on my first trip to Balakov, when I was just interviewing elderly Ukrainians who had been there during World War II, was that during the first Aksyon, when the 1,000 people were rounded up, they were kept first in a local building and tortured for about a day and a half before they were taken to this mass grave. And one of the things, apparently, that they were forced to do was to, the Germans and the Ukrainian accessories would make the Jews form these pyramids, and they would put the rabbi on the top, human pyramids, and put the rabbi on the top and knock him off and beat him. And so when I read about Abu Ghraib, I had to pause and wonder, what is it that makes people want to do this terrible sort of ritual humiliation of building people into these sort of weird perversions of buildings, you know, because that's what a pyramid is. and then destroying it. It seemed to me to be a kind of metaphor for civilization and destruction right there, that you, this weird mock building up and knocking down. And I was just, because I'd been so electrified by this fact when I first heard it about Balakhov, when the Abu Ghraib thing happened, of course, it was the first thing I thought of.
And what did it mean to you? What were you thinking of knowing that Americans had done this to Iraqis?
Well, I thought the natural thing that you end up thinking when you study the history of the Holocaust, which is that anybody is capable of anything, and that there is no nation that has claim to moral superiority. I mean, I think that much has been made clear, and that there's some very base, low human impulse toward desecration and torture and violence that exists apparently in everybody. You know, the thing about the Holocaust, especially in little Eastern European towns where neighbors turned about against neighbors, that you keep getting is that otherwise normal-seeming people would, if under the right combination of circumstances, turn into what one of my survivors kept referring to as cannibals, savages. And that certainly ran through my mind, and it continues to run through my mind, and it's the thing that has impressed me most. You don't feel safe anymore after you think about this material because you realize anybody could do anything.
You know, you've pointed out that you think of yourself as the last generation to have come in direct contact with, you know, to have grown up with people of that Holocaust generation of Jews. You're the grandchild of people who survived the Holocaust and of people who were killed in the Holocaust. And after that, as you point out, it's history. People will know of it as history. I don't know what my question is there, but I think we are very aware of a generation dying out.
Well, I was certainly possessed by this notion all through my life and certainly the writing of my book, which is that, you know, history is specific. It's not general. It's certain people at certain times. And my generation is essentially the last generation in the history of this planet that will have been in a position to talk to know, as a subsequent generation, knowing an older generation, the people who went through the Holocaust. And after us, it's all people who will never have direct personal contact with Holocaust survivors, with people who were there. And the question I keep thinking about, and which I was possessed by as I wrote my book, is what happens to this event then? There will come a time in our lifetime in which the last Holocaust survivor dies. What happens then? How does this event then get transmitted to a subsequent generation to whom it can never be a tangible reality, a memory of what an old man looked like or smelled like or felt like? And that's the thing that I kept thinking of. And I think that we're the hinge. You know, my generation, kids who knew old people in the 1960s and 70s who were Holocaust survivors, are the last generation to have that. And as a person who's a writer, as a person who's a scholar of lost civilizations, I'm very interested in the phenomenon of how a person's or a generation's lived experience becomes the narrative that is transmitted to a subsequent generation. And of course, what my book is trying to do is to, in some sense, be that narrative. And it's very aware of itself as that narrative. And the people who were talking to me knew that they were entrusting to me like a precious little package, and they knew I was going to be the one to give it to many other people when they couldn't anymore. And that was a very moving thing.
Well, Daniel Mendelsohn, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Daniel Mendelsohn is the author of The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million.